Good morning. Hey. No conflicts of interest, although my wife tells me I have many interests that are in conflict. And I think since I'm not a member of any of these institutions, I'm a tenured professor, I can actually say that I have some things to say that I think might challenge, or I would like to challenge my colleagues who represent these great institutions, that we need to figure out how to respond to the appropriate debate. The question is, are we having the right debates today? At least this is what I challenge my students to say. We've focused on the global burden of disease now since 1996. And we're still doing global burden of disease studies and showing that mental illness is at the top of the list and is slated by 2030 to be at the top list for all countries. I think that debate is over. The real debate, I think, is that we are having something of a debate between these institutions and what's the best response to the problem of mental illness. The fact of the matter is, Tom Insel wrote this article in 2006 with Skolnick, and he was reviewing that, in fact, although we've made progress in mental illness treatment, I could cite lots of data that shows that we've made two steps forward and probably one and a half back for every step in progress. In terms of age of onset, it's been declining. The average age of onset for mental illnesses is declined to about ages 15 to 24 for first onset of the most common mental disorders, mood, anxiety, and substance abuse. That's not progress. Although we have better drugs, the fact of the matter is 30% don't respond to any of that. It requires very invasive techniques. Stigma is still high, prevalence is going up, not down, and, once broken, Humpty Dumpty can't be put together again. Once you've had one bout, chances are you'll have another bout sometime in your lifetime. If you've had a second, it goes up to 70. If you had the third, it's 90%. In my opinion, the response in this article, I think, was the definition of insanity, at least according to Benjamin Franklin, which was to say, give me more money to do the same thing, but let's expect different results. Let me find a cure. I side with George Albee, who said this in 1959 when Congress tried to create the NIMH. He wrote an article. He said that it's not possible to create enough therapists and psychiatrists to treat our way out of the problem. You all know this. Public health has taught us this time and time again. And yet we continue to put more of our research dollars in understanding the brain and our biology and the idea that somehow we can treat our way out of this problem of mental illness. Public health knows this, but they have no response other than to help states coordinate services. Well, we do have an alternative, and it is to promote and protect good mental health. Nobody is doing that. In fact, we can measure, this is an article from 2002, and we've been saying for years that mental health is more than the absence, yet we didn't bother to actually go around and measure it first, because if it doesn't get measured, it doesn't count. And if it doesn't get counted, it sure the heck doesn't count in Congress, or right, in terms of funding. So I'm not going to show you the measure. I'll simply say that we've gone from a long form, mental health continuum long form that had 40 plus items, down to a clinical assessment that's almost like the PHQ. It's called the Mental Health Continuum Short Form, 14 items that can be administered easily in 10 minutes, if less. And we measure people's emotional well-being, their psychological and their social well-being, and we use a diagnosis in the same way the DSM approaches it to say, good mental health, that is flourishing, you have to have one of the three symptoms of good emotional health, that is feeling good, happy, satisfied, or interested in life, almost every day or every day in the last month. On top of that, you have to have 6 of the 11 symptoms of functioning well in life, psychological or social, things like purpose in life, social integration, a sense that the things you do on a daily basis matter to your community, a sense that you have the confidence to think and express your own ideas, that you're accepting of yourself, but also socially accepting of other people. It's a long list of functioning well. So to flourish means you have to have 7 out of the 14 signs and symptoms of positive mental health almost every day or every day in the past month. And there is, of course, a a problem on this mental health continuum, and it's the absence of good mental health. It's called languishing. To languish is to say that you never, or maybe once or twice in the last month, felt one of those three emotional, and you never, or maybe once or twice in the past month, felt one of those 11, at least 6 out of the 11 functioning. Languishing means to be running on empty, have no meaning in life, no sense of good, no bad. So we can measure positive mental health. We've gone from 40 to 14 items, and we've been able to test a very fundamental hypothesis that has been with us since the WHO wrote its definition of health. That hypothesis has not been tested. That is, that health is more than the absence of illness, precisely because we think illness is far more serious. This is the reaction I get to my work from the halls of Congress. Well, Corey, bless your heart, when we get done with the really serious stuff, that is, treating mental illness, we can fund your stuff on promoting and protecting mental health. Well, it ain't so, people. Why? Because it's true. When you can measure positive mental health at any, whatever measure of mental illness we put in there, whether we're measuring this in adolescents in our country, adults in our country, adults in the Netherlands, adults in South Africa, we found again and again, they correlate no more than minus 0.5. Yes, the absence of mental illness tends to have, you tend to have higher levels of well-being, but mental illness and mental health belong to separate dimensions in the population. That's what it looks like. We call it the two continuum model. So, and the point here is that when we say in our documents from now on, when I read a document, when you say you want your population to be mentally healthy, what you really ought to be trying to achieve is getting more of your population on this side of the continuum, ideally free of mental illness, and then ideally moving them towards flourishing. The fact of the matter is, there's lots of implications that come from the dual continuum model. Not the least of which is the following. If we had a cure, according to Insulin Skolnick, if I could take my genie out of the bottle and say one wish, we could cure all mental illnesses today. It would not guarantee we would be anywhere near flourishing. It's true, the absence of mental illness does not necessarily mean most of your population is flourishing. So I want to show you the research that says why we need both treatment, but we need a far more upstream approach, which is to protect and promote what is really good in our lives. Because when we lose it, we have data to show what happens. We become mentally ill. So here's, I'm going to show you this quickly. Ken Kendler and I have done several papers that show that genetically, there is a genetic basis to the dual continuum as well. It's not an artifact of our minds. And by the way, I don't have time, but cholesterol also belongs to the dual continuum model. Another implication of the dual continuum, statins lower bad cholesterol, but they don't necessarily promote high levels of good cholesterol. Guess what? Drug companies have found out it takes a different biological agent, a different drug, to raise good cholesterol. And ultimately, if you give people both, you put them in the flourishing cholesterol quadrant, and you get really good heart health outcomes. I mention it only to say this is not an artifact of our mind. It is in our body, and it's in our DNA. We showed that the first, mental health, as I measure it, is highly heritable in the U.S. adult twin population. 72% heritable. Just as heritable as mental illness. That is, and when we, in our study, we are measuring major depression, panic disorder, and generalized anxiety disorder in the past year. We know again and again that internalizing psychopathology is highly heritable. So we go looking for the genes that will help us translate that into better treatments. Well, guess what? Positive mental health is just as heritable. And the best-fitting model, even though I have a measure that says it consists of different types of well-being, all three types of well-being come from a common genetic source. That's the common factor model. And in our population, men and women have the best, we're not different when it comes to the heritability of positive mental health or mental illness in this, our study. But here's what we found in our second paper. The phenotypic correlation in our twins is minus 0.54. It's almost exactly the same in the U.S. adult population. In that 2005 paper, it was minus 0.53. 86% of that phenotypic correlation is mediated genetically. Now, that's not a precise measure, but it suggests most of the correlation is mediated through genes. Notwithstanding that, what we found was the additive genetic variance for this highly heritable construct and this highly heritable construct shared no more than 50%. No more. And then 10 years later, it went down to 41%. That is to say, we inherit two capacities. One, a level of risk for mental illness, and one, another that's relatively independent. Half of it is independent, a risk for flourishing or positive mental health. Yet here we go searching for the pathology genes to understand where we need to go, when in fact we ought to be understanding the epigenetics that unlock positive health, is my argument and Ken's argument. Look at how distinct the environmental sources of variance are. Only 5% of the unique environment causes of mental illness are shared in common with the things that cause positive mental health. So all that we know about through risk reduction research that focuses only on mental illness does not necessarily translate into the things we want to understand that promotes good mental health. So, in the next 5 minutes, I'll go over my implications of the two continuum model. And there's lots of data to show this, right? We've heard this again and again. The absence of mental illness does not mean the presence of mental health. True. But also another implication is just because you have mental illness does not mean you have the complete absence of good well-being, right? Here's college students in a paper that is being published hopefully this probably in 2012. Using the patient health questionnaire in the past 2 weeks, whether they had depression, panic disorder, or generalized anxiety, 75% were free of that. Most of our policies would stop short of that, right? Okay, if that 75% must be doing well. We can't find it's less than 50% of our U.S. college students actually are free of the common colds of mental disorders on our flourishing. Less than half. So we're nowhere near the fact that just because you're free of mental illness that most of these kids, in this case, are doing well. But look at this, 25% would screen positive for one of those three in the past 2 weeks, but in the past month, almost 6% were flourishing. Most had moderate mental health, and thankfully only 2.8% were languishing. So the presence of mental illness does not mean you have the complete absence of mental health. Now, why is that important? Because the second implication, level of mental health matters with and without mental disorder. Now let's stay focused on those kids, those college students. Here's, again, those who screened free of those common mental disorders, but we're looking at whether they engage in any suicidal behavior or thoughts, and that is plans, attempts, or in the past 4 weeks. So whether they had thought seriously about killing themselves, made a plan, or whether they had actually attempted to kill themselves. And what you see here is that almost the marked increase, actually, although it looks lowest in the flourishing, it doubles at least in the moderate, and it goes up to 15% of those who are languishing. Now, these are the kids who are free. Now, here are the kids who screen positive for mental disorders. Again, level of mental health matters. If you're flourishing, that almost 6%, they had the lowest risk, if you will. It goes up by half easily if you have moderate, and it goes up dramatically if you screen positive, but you're languishing. Now, this is just one of several studies we published again and again showing that whether it's missed days of work, chronic diseases, you name it, level of mental health, positive mental health, matters with a mental disorder and without. If you can maintain some level of well-being, even though you have mental illness, you're functioning better. Third, and I'll end here, implication three is we want to change the thinking around mental health. What's more serious? What do we need to target? Well, the attitude seems to be target mental illness and then we'll give you whatever's left over for promotion. Well, we think health is precedes it, and the losses of good mental health precede risk for mental illness. And in fact showed this in a paper that was published in the special issue of the American Journal of Public Health just this last December on promotion and protection, thanks to the support of the CDC and some SAMHSA colleagues. So I'm going to skip over this. It's very changeable. What I really want to show you is the following. Here's the adjusted odds ratios of having one of those three common mental disorders in 2005, controlling for whether you had one of those three in 1995. And this is the U.S. adult population. We studied them in 95, followed them up in 2005. So, and we're comparing these odds ratios against that bar in red, those people who stayed flourishing. So let's make the case for protecting against the loss of mental health. Why? Because here are people who are flourishing in 1995, but they declined just at one level. They went down to moderate. Right? Their risk has gone up almost four times compared to if they had stayed flourishing. Then we've got here the group that this is being compared to, those who stayed moderately mentally healthy. Compared to those who stayed flourishing, we're almost four and a half times more likely to have one of those mental disorders in 2005. But if they declined to languishing, most of those people were moderately mentally healthy in 1995. Look at the risk almost doubles. It goes up to over eight times more likely that they're going to have a mental disorder, one of those three, in 2005, compared to those who had stayed flourishing. So we would have made progress just keeping some of our population in moderate mental health. Here's the case for promotion. Well, the first case is this, where that arrow starts. If you had stayed languishing, you're over six and a half times more likely to have one of those three mental disorders in 2005 compared to those who stayed flourishing. But we will have made progress if we had just taken people from languishing to moderate mental health. We've cut the risk almost by half. Yes, for those who had proved to moderate, now these were people who were languishing in 1995. In 2005, they're up to moderate. We've reduced the risk, but they're still more likely, almost three and a half times more likely than those who stayed flourishing, to have one of those three mental disorders in 2005. It's only when we take people to flourishing. Most of these people were moderately mentally healthy in 1995. Only then do we get the lowest risk of future mental illness. Now, I can't show you the next graph. I don't have time, but I could tell you essentially, I'll show you the odds ratio of what mental illness is if you'd started out with one of those three in 1995. You're five times more likely to have one of those three in 2005 compared to had you stayed flourishing. But what you should notice, and this is 10% of the population right here, those people were free of any of those three in 1995, but because they were languishing, have a higher risk of developing one of those three than those who started out with them. And this is almost 40% of our adult population right here who have moderate mental health. And they're almost as likely to develop mental illness as those who started out with them. So why aren't we making progress? I think we're focusing too much on the wrong thing. If you want more mental health, let's start measuring it and promoting it. Thanks.